recording that from now, and we will jump into our class. So first of all, as you can see, we're really dealing with current events. Ukraine, Poland, Russia, all this area is in the core of our discussion today. Before we try and explain what Hasidut is, and again, I will use the term Hasidut, not Hasidism, not Hasidic, not... all right, you understand what I'm talking about? But before we dive into what Hasidut is, we need to, I would say, go on, as I love to say, on a time machine, all the way back to the 17th century, to Eastern Europe, try and understand the, I would say, historical events that took place back then, and only by that we will go ahead and we will understand what exactly or what is the ground that from it the Hasidut rised up in the 17th century. So the Jewry in Poland, and when I say Poland, it's not the modern Poland that we know, it's also the modern Poland, but it, I would say, added many, many, many lands that are not in Poland. Actually, most of this kingdom, this commonwealth is not Poland. As you can see, it has entire Belarus, Ukraine, Lithuania, the little Russia place between Lithuania and Poland, Latvia, some of Estonia, and the very western part of Russia as well. This was the Poland, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth of the 17th century. It was a Catholic commonwealth, very strong, very wealthy, that lasted for several decades. And the Jews that lived in this kingdom lived very good lives. We have to say, very, very good lives, because they're very knowledgeable. They were very learned. Most of them, not everyone, but most of them learned how to write, how to read, unlike many other of the inhabitants of those areas. For example, the Ukrainians, which are called the Cossacks. We'll talk about it in a minute. Okay? And the Jews lived very good lives back then in Poland. Not only that, we know that there were more than a million Jews back then, and until the Holocaust. There were more than a million Jews in this area, and in Poland specific back then, and it was a very good place for Jews to live in. It was a very, very good place for Jews to live in. They were very close to the Polish church, very close to the kingdom, very close to the Commonwealth, and the Commonwealth used them because they were learned, because they were knowledgeable, they had skills, and they used them, I would say, for what Jews are very good at, because we're all Jews, we can say it, very good in taxes and money. So the Commonwealth used the Jews in order to, what is called, to execute all the taxes, I would say, collecting that they had to collect from their farmers, from the Ukrainian farmers, from the Belarusian farmers, from the Lithuanian farmers, etc., etc., etc. And the Jews were somewhere in between the middlemen, between the simple people back then in the Commonwealth, and we would say the Polish royalty that wanted a lot of money. And something happened in what is called in Hebrew Praot Tachtat. Praot Tachtat, Tach is Tafchet, Tat is Taftet. Those are years 1684, 1648, 1649. Something happened in those years because the Cossacks, which were the Ukrainian farmers, the very, I would say, ignorant, very simple life living, very, very poor farmers, decided they want to rebel against the Polish Commonwealth, against the Polish princesses, the princes, like against the Polish king and the Polish monarchy in general, because they said, you're taking too much money from us, we are the one who works the field, and you're taking all the harvest and as taxes, and we work and we stay poor. And they thought, what is the best way we can rebel against the Polish-Lithuanian monarchy, Commonwealth? And as you would probably not be surprised to hear, let's attack Jews back then, because the Jews were those who were in charge of collecting the taxes. And they were targeted as someone who is not Polish, but the Polish need in order to take the taxes. So they said, let's kill as many Jews as possible. And between 1648 and 1649, there were masses of killings and murders in Jewish communities in all the Polish-Lithuanian area. And those rebellions were led by what we called Bogdan... Exactly. Or Bogdan HaRasha, Bogdan the Wicked. He was the one who he was the leader of those Cossack groups, and many Jews were killed. 700 and 70 Jewish communities were destroyed to ashes. 770 Jewish communities. And we're talking now 300 years before the Holocaust. All right? 300 years before the Holocaust. All right? And after the Christian Crusades. We're talking about somewhere in between 17th century. All right? And it was a huge, I would say, this event had a huge impact on the Jewish community back then. Think really like the Holocaust of our generation also. That not only that generation that suffered from those attacked were harmed, but also second and third generation. And after 740 communities were totally destroyed, the Jewish community was broke, and there was a lot of pain going on. And two movements, two very important movements in Jewish history, rised up from this, I would say, gap or those ashes. The first one, and the bigger one, maybe not the most famous one today, is the group of people that followed a person named Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi was a Jew. He was 20 years old when all of this happened. So he experienced all of this happened, all of those attacks, all of the war happened. He was very young. He was 20 years old. He experienced the disasters and catastrophes of the Jewish communities back then. And he decided that for some reason that we're not going to talk about now, that he was revealed, God revealed himself to him, and he spoke with the angels, and he declared himself as the Messiah, as the Mashiach. He took a red veil, and just like the Zohar says, that the Mashiach would come with a red veil, and he sat and he read Eicha, the scroll of Eicha, all night long, and he cried, and he said, I'm going to be done. And he really felt he is the Messiah after everything that happened. He called this, I would say, pogroms and those the catastrophe that happened in 1648, 1649, as what is called Chevlei Mashiach. Chevlei Mashiach is the disasters before the Messiah comes. We believe from the prophets and also from the Zohar that before the days of Messiah, they're going to be very bad days, very wars, nations are going to fight other nations. And he thought, wow, this is what happened. And now the Messiah is supposed to come. And he declared himself a Messiah. And believe it or not, masses of Jews throughout Europe followed Shabtai Tzvi. They really believed in Shabtai Tzvi. It's called Sabbatism. They really believed in him and they followed him in everything that he said. And this movement was a big movement. Not only by simple people, rabbis. Rabbis back then followed it. Now, we're not talking about Orthodoxy, Reform, Conservative. This is way later. This is 3-4 generations later. We're talking about Jews in general. And also rabbis, wealthy people, many people from all the levels of society followed Shabtai Tzvi. And what is the end of it? Maybe some of you know. He was forced to convert himself to Islam. He became a Muslim, not because he wanted it, but because the Muslim king back then in Turkey, he said, no way there is another person in my kingdom who's going to declare himself to be a king. I'm the only king. I'm the only leader. He called him. He said, are you going to become a Muslim or I'm going to hang you tomorrow on the highest tree that I find in Turkey. So he decided to convert himself, not to convert himself, but to I don't know what's the verb in English, to become a Muslim. To convert also? Okay, to convert to Muslims, to Islam. But that wasn't because he wanted it, just wanted to stay alive. Many people think, no, he converted to Islam because he... No, he converted to Islam just because he was forced to convert to Islam. If not, he would stay... He just wanted to stay alive. But what happened, what people could never assume that would happen, is that masses of the people who followed him, they chose to convert to Islam. All right? They chose to convert to Islam, and many people converted to Islam back then, and again, because this movement of Sabbatism expanded from where we're talking now, all the way where we call, towards, we will say, a Greek, Turkey, all the way afterwards to Gaza and Israel. All right? And they went to the Muslim monarchy back then. Many, many, many of his followers decided to convert themselves. All the way until today, there are people, not very, very few in the world, called Sabbatism, the Shabtaim, the Sabbatites, and they still believe that maybe Shabtai Tzvi was the leader and he was the Messiah and everything happened. This is one movement which we need to understand before we talk about Hasidut. One movement that was a reaction, a response to the catastrophes of the 1648-1649 crusades in the Jews. The second one starts with a young man called Eleazar, and Eleazar. And this Eleazar, Eleazar, I don't remember now. This Eleazar, let's call him Eleazar. This Eleazar was kidnapped by the Cossacks back then, and in 1649. He suffered a lot in the war, but thanks God he was released, and he went back home to Ukraine where he lived at. And he married a woman, and they gave birth to a young baby called Israel. That was his name. Israel grew up after those wars, those fights, those combats, and he grew up just like the second generation of the Holocaust in a family where those catastrophes were present, very present in the stories of their parents, in the stories of his father, and he grew up understanding that his family and his people gone through a very, very harsh disaster, very, very big catastrophe. And he read a book. The book, this young boy, Israel, when he grew up, he read the book. The book is called Magid Meisharim. Magid Meisharim is a book written by Rabbi Yosef Karo. Those of you who attended my halacha classes, you remember we talked about Rabbi Yosef Karo from Tefat. He wrote the Shulchan Aruch. He was also a big Kabbalist. A big Kabbalist. And he wrote a Kabbalah book called Magid Meisharim, which is like an autobiography of himself talking with a divine spirit that talks to him and tells him what you should do, what you should not do, what are the secrets of the world. This is like an autobiography that he wrote down. And this young boy, Israel, read it. And this young boy, later on, tells about himself, and other people tells him about him, that he had almost a similar experience, just like Rabbi Yosef Karo had, that he tells about himself that he went up to the skies and he spoke with the devil and he spoke with the Messiah, and the Messiah told him a lot of stuff, and he decided he needs to expose as many people as possible to the secrets that he was told. And this young boy, Israel, is going to be what we call the Baal Shem Tov. All right? Rabbi Israel Shem Tov, Rabbi Israel ben Eliezer, he is the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidut movement. Rabbi Israel Baal Shem Tov. That's his name. Or the Besht. You can call him the Besht, which is the initials of the Baal Shem Tov. Baal Shem Tov. Let's see a little bit of the Baal Shem Tov before we move forward. Any questions so far? With the history class? We started with a little history class today. Okay, look please in those important, the founders of Hasidut. You can see this is maybe portrayed, maybe not, we don't know. As usual, of the Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Israel ben Eliezer. He's what is going to be the founder of the Hasidut, even though his, I would say, impact on Hasidut or the exposure that many people had are not especially thanks to him. He had many, very few students, and they sat down in a city called Mezhibuzh in Ukraine, in western Ukraine. This is the dot, the black dot that you can see in Ukraine. In a very small village, there were a couple of Jews there. And he studied with them the Kabbalah. He studied with them many, many secrets about himself. He's being told, we know, because of his students and things that he writes about himself, that he had the special, superstitious powers, right? That he could heal a woman that he would see. There is a story, for example, about one of his servants, when he was grown up, and he went to take a nap. Baal Shem Tov.
Supernatural,
thank you. What's superstitious?
Oh,
Munat Pela. So not superstitious. Maybe some would say, Michael. Not superstitious. Supernatural, thank you. And there is a story that is being written on him about him that he went, Baal Shem Tov went to take a nap one afternoon, and he had his shoes next to his bed, and he had a servant, the shamash, in his home, and the shamash cleaned the room while the Baal Shem Tov was sleeping. Just one story about the Baal Shem Tov. And when the Baal Shem Tov woke up, he saw that the shoes are still next to his next to the bed, and no one touched them, even though the entire room was clean. So he went to the shamash, to the servant, and he asked the servant, "Did you touch my shoes? Did you clean them? Did you take them away or put them back?" The servant said, "No, I'm sorry. I would never touch your highness, your shoes, and we'll never do it." So the Baal Shem Tov told him, "There's going to be a bracha on your head. You don't know when, you don't know what, you're going to be a bracha." Later on, the person who wrote the stories tells or he says, you can decide for yourself if that's true or not, we can talk about it later, that he went for decades afterwards to visit a person, and he went to his home just to ask a question or get tzedakah or something, and he saw a little boy screaming, or a young adult, a young adult screaming and shouting on a very old person on what seems to be his father or his grandfather. So he hesitated, should I tell him to stop, kibud horim, something, it's not nice. So he said, okay, let's ask the young boy, why are you shouting on your father? What are you doing? So he said, no, he's not my father, he's my son. And it's been believed that the Baal Shem Tov, with his power, with the bracha, because this servant did not touch his shoes, he never grew up and he stayed young adult forever, and his child became an adult, and he never grew up to become an old person. Just one short story that is being told about the Baal Shem Tov. You can Google it later. There's many stories about the Baal Shem Tov. He's being, in the Hasidut in general, as someone who has powers. Now, before you smile, you laugh, you say, wait, this is not real, what are they talking about it? I will just raise a question. What's the difference between saying that or talking about, I don't know, our prophets in the Tanakh? Just raising a question, where do we put our limits when we say a story can be something that is legit, or where can we say that a story is not legit? Just for you to raise up a question, we can talk about it later on. So the Baal Shem Tov, when he spoke with this Mashiach, the Mashiach told him something that every chassid, doesn't matter if he's a Lubavitch or a Breslover or a Babov, needs to know, everyone. And this I'll say in Hebrew, and then I'll try to translate it. Kol ot va'ot nitzotzot olamot neshamot ve'elokut. Every letter and letter, this is the Mashiach, according to the story that he went up to the sky and talked to the Mashiach told him, every letter and letter has deeper worlds, a world in it, has neshama, has a soul in it, and has also elokut, divine God inside of it. And every and each thing in the world, you can find God inside. Every and each thing in the world is only, what you see is only the first layer. There is a huge world behind it, also in objects, also in food, also in feelings, also in human beings, in the nature, in everything. What you see, what you experience with your eyes is only the first layer. I would say the superficial layer, all right? And there is way a very deep ocean of thought and a very deep ocean of meanings behind it. This is the most, I would say, important message that the Baal Shem Tov says that he received from this Mashiach. And by that, he started to learn more and more Kabbalah, that we spoke about last week. And he started to teach Kabbalah to not too many people, but actually to few people in his area. The most, I would say, a famous one, and the one who is being called his successor, is called the Magid Mimezrich. The Magid is Rabbi Dov Baer of Mezrich. And he was his student. He died not a lot of time afterwards, like 12 years afterwards, but he's counted to be his successor. And he learned Kabbalah from a Baal Shem Tov, and he also founded, after the Baal Shem Tov passed away, he also founded this group of learning with many people. But again, we're talking about a very small circle of people that are learning Kabbalah. Not something that you would think that would change Judaism forever. But this group of people called themselves the Chevraya Kadisha, the Holy Brotherhood. And every and each person from this group took on himself to be a shaliach. What does it mean to be a shaliach? It means I am going to spread the word to as many people as possible. I am going to spread the word to as many people as possible. So they learned Kabbalah from the Magid Mimezrich. He told them all the secrets of the world, all the secrets that we know from we spoke about last week. And every and each person from this group decided to go to a different place, to a different village in this commonwealth, and to try and convince as many people as possible and to teach them about the secrets of Judaism. Believe it or not, this was a huge success. This was a huge success. Many masses of people throughout Europe started gathering around those groups of people. For example, just to say the names of them. For example, you have Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi. Who knows who's Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi? You all heard of him. Baal HaTanya, he is the founder of Lubavitch. He's the founder of Chabad. There's always there, Joel, there's some sources for you. He's the founder of Chabad. He was the student of the Magid Mimezrich. One person, another one, Rabbi Aaron of Kerlin. You heard about Kerlin? Kerlin is another Chatzar Hasidic, another Hasidic group. Lijansk, Rabbi Elimelech of Lijansk, Zanoam Elimelech. He was another, he formed another group in a city called, in a village called Lijansk. Rabbi Zusha of Fanipol, he was the brother of Rabbi Elimelech of Lijansk. He also had a Hasidic group. Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, the Berdichev Hasidism is from there. And there were many, many more. I put it on the page. Another one, Rabbi Yaakov Yitzchak of Lublin, called the Chozemi Lublin, the Seeker of Lublin. Also, the a person that from his descendants, their Hasidut that we know as Satmar, as Gur, for example, which we'll talk about it here. But those students, those pupils of the Magid Mezrich, took on a mission to go and spread the word of the secrets of the Torah, of the Kabbalah, to any Jew that they find. And it worked very well. Now, why would it work very well? And then I go back to the opening. Because this was the second generation after the disaster, the catastrophes of 1648, 1649. After the Kozak war in the Jews. And they looked for meaning, for an answer. What happened to my parents? What happened to my grandparents? What happened to the Jewish community that I grew up in, that I heard of? And they gave them meaning. Those rabbis, the Baal Shem Tov, then the Magid Mimezrit, and then his holy brotherhood, the Chevraya Kadisha, gave people a meaning, something to hang up on. And not like Shabtai Tzvi, who said, I am the Messiah, follow me. They said, no, none of us is a Messiah. By the way, no Hasidic rabbi. Maybe Breslev, maybe Rabbi Nachman of Breslev. And I'm not talking about the last Lubavitcher, Never a Hasidic rabbi said he is the Messiah. Never. All right, by the way. And I'll tell why in a minute, because Shabtai Tzvi, okay? But not like Shabtai Tzvi, who said, you know what? There is nothing, we're going to turn everything upside down. I'm the Messiah. No more rules, nothing. They said, no, wait, we're Jews. We need to keep to observe Torah. We need to observe Halacha. We need to learn Torah. But there is meaning from the skies that the heavens and God is telling us something, and we need to expand the word of God. This is how Hasidism and Hasidut started in the world. From this ground, it grew up to be what we know today. And back then, even though it worked very well, the Sabbatism was still very good. The Sabbatism worked for the Shabtaut, as we say in Hebrew, was working for around 100, I would say like 300 years later. All right, it's something that worked all the way until today. There are some descendants of those Shabtaim. And what happened? Many rabbis back then in Poland and Ukraine, specifically in the area of Lithuania, said, wait, how do I know if the rabbi in the shul next to me is a Hasid or maybe he's a Shabtai? How do I know what to? They both learn Kabbalah. They continue the word of God. How should I distinct? How should I know? Is the rabbi next to me is part of my group, but he's just a Hasid, or maybe he's a Shabtai, maybe he's following Shabtai Tzvi. And this confusion, folks, this confusion led to what we call the Misnagdim. The Misnagdim, the opponents, or in other words, the Litvak, you may hear it, the Litvak, the Lithuanians. This group is the group that was opposing the Hasidism, was opposing Hasidut. The origins of this group was, we don't know how to distinct between Hasidism and Shabtaut, between the Sabbatism and Hasidut, and we must, for some reason we don't know, we need to oppose everyone, to ban everyone, not to speak with them, not to do, also to burn their books, to do everything. Now, what would you think? Why? What happened here? So I will tell you very simple. As I learned from, in general, there is a very very profound and amazing scholar in Israel called Professor Rachel Elior. Maybe you heard her name. She's the head of Jewish philosophy in the Hebrew University. And she said something very simple, but very, very important. When she's talking about the Hasidut and the Misnagdim and the opponents, she's saying, what's the difference? I mean, also the opponents, they learned Kabbalah. They know what Kabbalah is. None? No, there is many, maybe only the Yekim, and not even them, say that Kabbalah is something that is maybe you should never learn. They learn Kabbalah. They acknowledge the existence of Kabbalah. They know that Kabbalah exists. Why were they so, I would say afraid, but why were they so terrified from this movement of Hasidut? What happened? And she said something amazing. She said that if we try to clarify or we try to sharpen the difference, where exactly they disagree, the Hasidism and the Misnagdim, is whether this Kabbalah should become something public or should remain something only to the rabbis, those upstairs, you know, those are the high society, those the elite people from the group, from the society. The Misnagdim, those opponents, they say, Kabbalah? Okay, Zohar? Okay. Not for everyone. Not for everyone. Learn, as we said, the Rambam said, learn first of all Talmud, Mishnah, Halacha, know how to pray, know the Tanakh. If you become a huge rabbi, then maybe at the age of 40, and not only later on, maybe you would open up a Kabbalah book. And how do we know that they did not oppose Kabbalah? Because one of the biggest Hasidic opponents was the Grand Gaon Mivilna. The Gaon of Vilna in the third generation of Hasidut was one of the biggest opponents to the Hasidut. He banned Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi. He refused to meet with him, with the founder of Lubavitch. He said, "I'm not meeting with this person. I'm not meeting with this Eid. I'm not. I don't want anything to do with him." But he, he was the student of another rabbi, but his rabbi was, he learned Kabbalah. And he was a student for rabbi, he learned Kabbalah, and he yet was the biggest opponent to the Hasidism. Why? Because he said, not everyone are allowed to open the Kabbalah books. You're not spreading this word to everyone. It's only to the high society, it's only to the people who did. You need to focus on what we learned for decades and decades, which is Shas, Talmud, Mishnah, Halacha, learn the Seder, learn the stories of our Tanakh, and that's all. Don't open books that you should not open. And it's not only that. There were halachic, all the way until today, there are halachic ramifications about whether you're being posed a halacha like Hasidim or you're being posed a halacha like Misnagdim, like the opponents. Because Kabbalah has halachic ramifications. We spoke about it last week. For example, let's take a quick survey from the men here. Who wears tefillin in Chol HaMoed? Who wears tefillin in Chol HaMoed? None of you. Why not?
Like, why won't
Rebbe Lipper does?
Yeah.
Okay. Why wouldn't you?
The Gra didn't allow it.
The Gra didn't allow it. And why would Rebbe Lipper wear the tefillin? You know why? Someone on Zoom? Do you wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed? No. Vanessa says no. Nathan says no. No, people don't wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. But why? Halachically?
Family
minhag. Okay. But what is the original? What's the origin of that? What made the difference? No. The difference was that halachically, if you open Hilchot Tefillin in Yom Tov, we should wear tefillin in Chol HaMoed. We should. Halachically, we should wear tefillin in Chol HaMoed. The Kabbalah says, and specifically in the Zohar, that we should not wear tefillin in Chol HaMoed. The Kabbalah says we should not. So those of the families, why? There's many, many explanations. One means because of Keter. We say Keter during the Kedusha, and Keter Tefillin are Keter, a crown. There are no two crowns together in the same. There's many, many Kabbalic explanations for that. But look what happened. There are many, I don't know, do you come from a Hasidic family? No. Do you come from a Hasidic family? No. Do you come from a Hasidic family? Do you come from a Hasidic? No. None of you come from a Hasidic family. Harvey, do you come from a Hasidic family? Okay, one. Thank you. Baruch Hashem. Ira, Hasidic family? No. Okay, so none comes from a Hasidic family here, but none of you were to fill in on Chol HaMoed. What happened? Just to show you that there is the Hasidic movement had a huge influence on halachic world. So in general in Israel, no one, by the way, wears to fill in on Chol HaMoed. In Israel, we go through what is called Sfard. Sfard is the Hasidic way of halacha, the Hasidic way of prayer. In Chutz La'aretz, here, and in North America, and in Europe, specifically also in German, most of the people do wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed during Chol HaMoed, because they were very much the opponents against the Hasidism. Another thing, for example, that to see how Kabbalah has an influence in the Hasidic world that expanded in general. Do you know, we spoke about it last week, according to the Kabbalah, according to the Zohar, there is a belief in what is called, not resurrection, Gilgul HaShemot. How do you say that? That the soul moves from one person to another one.
Reincarnation.
Thank you. I'm not going to repeat that word. I have no idea how to pronounce it. And
reincarnation.
Thank you. Here we did it. Very good. I'll add it to my CV. And this concept of reincarnation Thank you. Is something that many Jews opposed for years, for decades. There's no such thing as reincarnation. It's Avodah Zarah. It's something that is external. It's strange. It's foreign. It's not Judaism, but the Kabbalah says it exists. Do you know an halachic ramification that comes from this? Do you know that according to the Hasidic Shechita, or some call it the Lubavitch Shechita, according to those Shechita, when you want to slaughter an animal to eat, the knife must be polished? Where the regular halacha says, no, you don't need to polish the knife from both sides, only from one side. But the Hasidim say, no, if you need a kosher animal to slaughter, is an animal that you slaughtered with a knife polished from both sides. Why? Because the slaughtering, the act, needs to be as efficient and quick and with less, I would say, harm and hurting the animal as possible. Why? Because you don't want to suffer. Why? Because you potentially slaughtering an animal with the soul of a tzaddik. Maybe there is a rebbe whose soul is inside this animal. Now think about it. Halachic ramification about how to slaughter an animal to eat. This is something that is very much deep in Kabbalah, and this is a ramification that was exposed to the world by the Hasidut. All right? So the Misnagdim were not only opening, I would say, opposing the Hasidut because of their to publicize the Kabbalah, but there are also halachic ramifications between the opponents, the Misnagdim, and the Hasidim. In a sense of that. Questions so far before we move forward? That's a good place to stop for questions.
I just have a quick question.
Yes, a quick question. Only one.
Yeah. Why did it split into so many branches?
Oh, we'll talk about it in a minute. That's our second, that's our second part of the class. Why did it... it's Eliezer, not Lazar. The first time I'm looking at my notes just to see that everything that I said was right. Yeah? Oh, we did talk about the blood libels, by the way. The blood libels. After 1648, 1649, and did not start there, it started also already in the 10th century. We all know the Christians who said, oh, the Jews are making matzot from the blood of the Christian babies and Christian children. And even though we all know, I don't need to convince anyone, but we all know that matzot are not being made out of blood, still, for almost, I would say, 900 years, there were people who actually believed it. The Jews make matzot for Pesach from matzot. Matzot is the special bread that we eat on Pesach. Matzah.
Okay.
Yeah, just
yeah,
the plural. Very good. So they believed, and they were very much convinced, that Jews prepare matzot from blood of young Christian kids. And again, 900 years, people thought about it. We need to understand it. And those blood libel, and by the way, if you're going to open an I would say an English dictionary or a foreign dictionary, you're going to look for in Hebrew what we call alilat dam, which is a blood libel. You would not find it. You would not find it. You know how it's called today? The official term still, it's a ritual. Ritual what? It's a ritual murder. Right. It's still called the official. It's still a ritual murder. Just to make clear that even though the world has changed, there are some things that still remain. So the Jews call it a blood libel, but it's not this is not the official term. All right? Open Wikipedia afterwards, you'll see. Ritual murder. Okay? Something that still exists. And if we go back to the Baal Shem Tov, he was very much influenced by those also, because he was in the generation of the blood libels. His parents were in the crusade of 1648, 1649, and he suffered also from those blood libels. And this is another thing that led him to establish this Hasidut. Okay.
Wait.
Yes, yes, Terry.
Wait, just because you mentioned it, and I wonder if you're going to bring it back at the very end, and I'm sorry if I'm spoiling it, but you said when it was
the Cossacks rebel against, yeah. 770
communities,
right,
were destroyed.
Right.
And this is why.
No.
This is just coincidence.
Just coincidence. Yeah. There's no. Again, 770. I probably someone circled it, right? Like we say, 6 million Jews were murdered in the Shoah. Take one, two less, more or less. Yeah, we say 770. It's very difficult to say that it's exactly 770. But this is the number that people say. Maybe this is the number that someone circled because of that. I have no idea. I don't think so.
Not,
yes.
Not to be too morbid, but 770 communities. How does that translate into individuals? Do you know?
I think when I prepared this year, I started around 50,000 people.
50,000.
Something around 50,000 people. Okay. Between 30,000 and 50,000
like
people.
Tiny villages.
Yeah. Yeah. Those called shtetls. Yeah. This is what happened back then. And again, back then for that generation, it was a Shoah. It was a Holocaust. It was the same thing as a Holocaust that is for our generation. And just like we might think about movement that started right from the Shoah, some would say the religious Zionism, some would say others, the response to the Shoah, Medinat Israel, the state of Israel, back then there were two responses, two I would say, reactions to this catastrophe. The first one was Shabtaut, the Sabbatism, and the second one was Hasidut, that rise from it. And because of confusion between the two, because they both carry on Kabbalah very much, the Misnagdim, the opponents, were against it. Okay. All right. Let's talk about the different, or let's talk about what we call Chatzer Hasidit. Or in other words, let's talk about now the essentials, the values of Hasidut. What exactly is Hasidut? What do they believe in? What makes them special? So first of all, we said about the Kabbalah and the Kabbalah halachic ramifications. But not only that, if we talk about, I would say more, in the way they are structured into groups, we talk about what is called in Hebrew, Chatzer Hasidit. Chatzer Hasidit would be, as we say, group, a Hasidic group. I don't know exactly what is the term in English. Like, there is Lubavitch, and there is Babov, and there is Breslov, and there is Karlin, there is Toldos Aaron, and there is Satmer, and there is Gur, and everything you can think of. There is Tanz, everything you can think of. Yeah?
Let's call it a branch.
Thank you, Joel. Let's call it a branch. A Hasidic branch. So first of all, the Hasidim live in small branches, in small groups. All right? Well, how did it happen? First of all, we had Baal Shem Tov. Then we had the Maggid of Mezritz. Look, please, on your the Hasidic tree. We'll go through it. Can we say what's going on here? We had the Baal Shem Tov. Then we had the Maggid. We had a little bit smaller, some smaller students also. But the Maggid of Mezritz was the most popular one. By the way, that's not all groups of Hasidut. There's still more and more. And this is updated to 2012, if I'm not wrong. Okay? There is more and more. And this is the biggest ones. The Maggid had his students, the Chevra Kadisha, the Holy Brotherhood, and they started, after they passed away, they started a war, an inside small war between two people, two persons, who's going to be the successor of the Rebbe, who's going to be. Usually it was between the son and the
son-in-law.
No.
Uncle.
No. The student. The most, I would say, student, the real student, the one who everyone knows he's following the Rebbe, or the son of the Rebbe. And many times, this war was, won to one side. Actually, there was a victory to one of the sides. Sometimes they just split away to two things, to two other, to a new Hasidut, to a new branch. So goes history on and on and on and on and on for 300 years. And here we are today, where we started with one Baal Shem Tov, then one Maggid of Mezritz, then eight students. Today we have, I think, around, 40-something different Hasiduyot, different groups. One second, Rachel. Where every in each group is being defined by what? By two things. First of all, the Rebbe. The Rebbe. Or in Hebrew we say Admor. Admor is Adoneinu, Moreinu, Verabeinu, our master, our teacher, our rabbi. In English we say the Rebbe, right? The Rebbe. Almost every Hasidut has a Rebbe. There are two Hasidut that don't have a Rebbe. Who are they?
Lubavitch
don't have a Rebbe today anymore. And?
Breslov.
Thank you. Lubavitch and Breslov are fascinating that we can just have an entire class about Lubavitch and Breslov. They don't have a Rebbe. Breslov had only one, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, which is very strange to Hasidut in general. He was the son of the grandson of the Baal Shem Tov. All right? He was the fourth generation to the Baal Shem Tov. He wasn't a student of any of those. He's just started by himself, by learning by himself, not with another rabbi. And he started the group of Breslov by himself. And back then, they were very strange also to other Hasidim. Other Hasidim saw Breslov and say, no, this is not Hasidut. All right? Today, it's one of the biggest Hasidut in the world. Not for no reason, because you don't know who belongs to Breslov and who's not, because there's no Rebbe and there is no documentation. Everyone, it's a social group. It's a social Hasidut. We call it the social Hasidut. Everyone can join Breslov. Also, with Lubavitch, Lubavitch had a lot of rabbis. Had a lot of rabbis, right? Starting from Baal HaTanya, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi, all the way until the Lubavitcher, right? All the way until the Lubavitcher. If I have time at the end, or maybe afterwards if you want, I will talk a little bit about the Messianic Chabad movement and about who's thought that Lubavitcher is the Messiah. We'll talk about it at the end. If we have time, remind me. But after he passed away, he was such a huge charismatic personality, and no one could actually success him. And Lubavitch today has no rabbi. at the Rebbe, and it's actually becoming, again, a social, just like Breslev, a social group that everyone can try to, I can go to Lubavitch, maybe I can daven with them, I go to eat in Lubavitch in a place, and now in the winter, we came back from Cancun, we ate in Bet Chabad, in the Lubavitch house. Everyone can connect to Chabad in such a way. That's not a group that you need to belong to, in a sense. Lubavitch is very interesting because their values are very different. What happened after the Lubavitch after post-Holocaust? Lubavitch before Holocaust are two different movements. It's amazing to think about also their, I would say, relations to the state of Israel. Lubavitch has wonderful things, has wonderful values, wonderful activities, but they also have some horrifying things within them. For example, the relations to the state of Israel. They don't recognize the state of Israel. They don't recognize the state of Israel being a part of Geula. The Geula would be only with the third temple, with sacrifices, with Kohanim in Jerusalem. Nothing that is, if it's not that, it's not a real Geula. And in Israel, it makes a lot of problem because they fund a lot of right extremism, what is called Noar Gvaot, the teenagers on the hills in Yehuda Shomron, which commit a lot of, not a lot, but there are some terror attacks against Arabs that are being funded by Chabad Lubavitch money because of that. We can discuss about later. It's very interesting how it goes on in Israel. But we will put that aside. So this is Lubavitch and Breslev. Again, Breslev is external to Hasidut. Lubavitch, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi, was, as you can see right here, he was one of the students of the Magid of Mezrich. He was a part of the Chevraya Kadisha. He was part of it. Now, let's move all the way to the right. We'll choose some just to explain. Rabbi Elimelech of Lizhansk, the Noam Elimelech, named by his book, one of the biggest Hasidic rabbis out there because he had many, many, many different groups coming out of him. As you can see, there was no one student that could say, I am the successor of him. There were two students. There was the Chose of Lublin, the Chose of Lublin, if you heard of him, the Seeker of Lublin, and there was Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Linsk. From Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Linsk, all the way until today, we have Tzanz on the one hand, or Kloisenberg, depends how you call it. Tzanz, Kloisenberg, they sit today in Netanya. Netanya is their city. There is an entire neighborhood in Netanya of Tzanz people. If you know Rabbi Usher Weiss, the Posek, the big Posek, he's Kloisenberg Tzanz, okay? And they are close cousins to Bobov, as we know from Toronto. But the Bobov Rebbe doesn't live in Toronto. He lives in Borough Park, right? Most of the rabbis, Hasidim, most of the rabbis live or in Bnei Brak or in Borough Park or in? Right, Monsi N. Williamsburg. Yes, exactly.
Vishnius in Haifa.
There's also in Haifa. There's Haifa, there's Rehoboth, there's Netanya, but most of them Bnei Brak, Williamsburg, Monsi, and Borough Park. Those are the places where the rabbis sit most of the time. And again, the moment the rabbi passes away, that's an entire, sometimes it's a fight who's gonna success it, man, who's gonna continue. So this is Linz. The other side of Lublin, we have many, many others. We have Satmar, it comes from Lublin. We have Gur, and another Gur. Why? Right? Why do we have three kinds of Gur? Again, who's gonna success? Okay, who's gonna be the successor, right? And we have Bels. You know, Bels, Gur, and Satmar are all close cousins, in a sense, coming from Lublin. And again, the differences would be who is your tzaddik, who is your rabbi, who is the rebbe, and in general would be what are the different values that you might have compared to other things. For example, Gur is a very rationalist Hasidut. All right, Gur is a very rationalist Hasidut. They're not very much into all the other parts. For example, is Breslev, which are very much into Zohar and Kabbalah. They add Kabbalah stuff, but they're very rationalist. They're very rationalist in the sense that they have their laws. They're very strict. You know what you do when you wake up. You know what you do when you go to sleep. You know how you get married. Those of you who saw Netflix, Unorthodox, I think it's called?
My Unorthodox Life.
No, the one with Shira Hass. I don't remember the name. My Unorthodox Life, it's called? The one, the name of it, what? Not Shtisol.
Unorthodox,
I think it's called. Talking about Gore, as you can see in Williamsburg. It's very, very, very interesting to see what's going on there.
Unorthodox.
I saw that one. Talking about Gore in Williamsburg. It's fascinating to see the life there. I know that some of it is right because my father grew up in a Gur neighborhood in Tel Aviv. He wasn't Gur, he was Litvik, but they lived in a Gur neighborhood. And the things going on there are, you may say, they're fascinating. Some would say they are a catastrophe. So this is Gur, Bels, Satmar. Satmar is very known to be
very strict.
very strict, like Gur, but very much
anti-Zionist,
right? A lot of connections with Iran, a lot of connection with anti-Zionist movement, with the BDS, very much because, again, because there is no way to establish the state of Israel without the permission of God. Again, there is a lot of religious, Zohar, Kabbalist things lying underneath it. There is more. Let's go all the way to the left. Vizhnitz. I know Vizhnitz because of the chalot that I hid in Israel. I don't know if you know, the Vizhnitz chalot are famous in Israel. They're the most, the Vizhnitz in Bnei Brak, city in Bnei Brak. They have their factory for the chalot. It's amazing. Vizhnitz is all the way left. All the way left here in the Hasidic tree. not in the Hasidic world. Some smaller, there's Kretschnif. They have the Rebbe lives in the Rehovot in Israel. Next to my, I went to a dish of the Rebbe of Kretschnif. Sloimim. Sadigura, and more and more. It's not everything, but that's, the biggest ones are right here. You know what's the biggest Hasidut in the world? Putting aside Lubavitch and Brest, that we don't know the numbers. You know what's the biggest one? Gur. Gur is the biggest one. Gur is the biggest one in the world. In Israel specifically, there are more than 20,000 households. More than 20,000 households that affiliate themselves to Gur. But they're very structured. They have documentation. They know everything. It's very, very good to see it. We don't know about others. Probably Lubavitch would be the biggest one, probably, if you would ask people. But again, we can't know who's actually Lubavitch anymore because Lubavitch became something more social, in a sense. I do want to talk about other stuff that are not tzaddikim before we finish the time, Rachel. So I'll finish in the 5 minutes that we have, and then I'll have time for questions. Other stuff that... make Hasidut, define it different than question?
One question.
But can we put it to the end, Joel, so I will finish? I'm sorry, I really apologize, we have 5 minutes.
Okay.
So another thing that defines Hasidut from other, I would say from other groups in Judaism or the opponents, is the fact that they have what is called Nitzotzot. Nitzotzot is sparkles, sparkles. Whatever. This is something that they learned from Baal Shem Tov based on Kabbalah. That again, every and each thing in the world has a sparkle inside of it that you should extract and lift it up to God.
Spark.
Thank you. Every spark that you should sparkle is a... Right, it's a different thing. Something with the glue, right? So there is a spark that you should extract and lift it up to the skies, to heavens, and sanctify it and glorify it. So every and each thing that Hasid does... has a spiritual meaning. For example, dancing. For example, drinking. For example, eating. For example, singing. For example, learning. For example, praying, talking. Everything that a human being is doing, every object, has a spark inside that should be extracted and lifted up. Okay, this is something that is being taught from the Baal Shem Tov that has Kabbalist, I would say, roots inside of it, based in the Zohar, based in other books. All right, and for example, this is why we know there is something called shiraim. What is a shiraim? If you've ever been to a Hasidic dish, it's a wonderful experience if you're a male. If you're a female, I'm sorry, you're going to be all the way in the other side of the women's section. You're not going to really experience something. But that's a huge hole. Like, you know, those halls, venues in Brooklyn, in Borough Park, in Williamsburg, also in Israel, where there is a huge dish, right, the table. Those of you who play their wardle, that's our ward dish in the wardle. There's a huge dish, a table, a long table. At the end of the table sits the Rebbe, right? And he eats, for example, a challah, a piece of challah, takes a small bite, and pass it over through every and each Hasidic person, guy that sits around the table. Usually he sits at the front. His student, his son will be next to him. There's a hierarchy in Hasidut, and they pass forward, they pass away all the challah, all the chunk, whatever that is, the kugel, whatever that is. He takes a bite and he moves forward because this is holy, because there's sparks inside, and because he's the tzaddik. And we talk about the tzaddik, the Rebbe. The Rebbe plays a very important role in the Hasidut because the Rebbe is like a pipe. He's a pipe between God, between heavens and earth. If you want to connect yourself to those divine sparks, you should... connect yourself, what is called in Dveikus. Dveikus. Dveikus means to glue yourself to the Rebbe. You should stick to the Rebbe because the Rebbe can lift you up to the heavens and he can turn himself down and take you from where you are and lift yourself all the way up to heavens. There is something called kvittel. What is a kvittel? A kvittel is a small envelope with a bracha that you ask from the Rebbe and a small, I would say, some coins, something for a bracha, some, loony, tuny, whatever you put inside, you give it to the Rebbe with the bracha, because you believe the Rebbe can come to you, lift you up, all the way to the heavens, to the skies, and help you in whatever you have. There's brachot, they have powers, they can do stuff like that, and the Rebbe is something that also exists after he dies. The Rebbe is something he should go back to his grave and go there and pray there, and because he has his influence and powers also after he passes away, in that sense. All right, that's why we know, for example, Breslev, they go every Rosh Hashanah to Uman in Ukraine. Let's see what's going to happen in the following Rosh Hashanah. If we talk about Ukraine, we'll see. You know, there is an entire, maybe we'll finish with that, there is an entire debate for years already in Breslev, whether to bring the remains and the bones of Rabbi Nachman of Breslev to Israel or not. They're very much against. Some are maybe now that's a good time when Ukraine is might be under fire. We'll see what's going to happen. Maybe there's no more. There's not a better time than now. Maybe the Shoah was, but maybe now that's a good time to bring his body back to Israel to be buried in Israel. And I just want to say to finish and say. That this is, I would say, an overview of what Chassidut is. But again, the influence, the I would say, the consequence, the ramifications of Chassidim, of Chassidut, in Jewish thought, in Jewish philosophy, in the way we daven, in the way we eat, in the way we drink, in the way we look at mitzvot, Sefirot HaOmer, for example, Lashem Yichud Kudsha Brichu, everything that we do, almost in everything we can find, influenced by the Kabbalah, the Chassidut, because the Chassidut is the group that took the Kabbalah that we learned last week and turned it into something public. Turn it into something that you can feel, you can act to, you can use. And the influence is amazing. And again, there is a huge world of Chassidut that we didn't touch. But thank you very much for this class. I'm here for questions. If you have any questions, I'm here starting with the people present in person after the Zoom. And then you have to say class dismissed, you're more than welcome to. Yes.
Number one, in terms of Jewish teaching, are there any differences between all the branches of Chassidut?
Yeah, it depends what you learn.
No, but I mean doing Jewish teaching, that is why we follow the religion. Like, you know, like in Judaism, you have the
Jewish traits, but not very much. Yes, for Gur has their traditions. There are different traditions. Yes, there are different traditions.
Yeah, but there are distinct differences between, you know, Orthodox, conservative. Is it similar in Hasidic?
No.
So
they're all
Orthodox. Teaching is the same.
So the Jew, in that case, if that's your question, it's all the same.
I mean, in terms of the basic essence of Judaism,
everything the same.
Right?
Everyone observes Shabbos, everyone observes Kashrut, everyone...
So they have the same rules.
All their women have shadows, everything is the same.
Everything is the same.
Yes.
So the only difference is just really who they follow, the way
they... So they follow
like the
different
the
traditions and values within.
The head of
the way they... We didn't talk about the clothes. There's different ways in the clothes, the socks, are wide, the strimal.
That's superficial.
Not very much. It's not very much superficial. There are a lot of... If you put white socks above the pants or under the pants, has Kabbalic, I would say, consequences, or Kabbalic meanings behind it.
But it doesn't affect the Jewish basic law.
No, but they would not marry with each other, for example. They would not marry with each other. There are some consequences to that. You're usually going to marry, in most of the places, someone who is from the same chatzar, from the same group, from the same branch.
That's not contrary to the Jewish teacher.
No.
That's what I mean.
No, so in that case, they're all the same.
In essence, they're not like reform and...
No.
Okay.
No.
Number two question.
Yes.
Now, you made a point, and that's something a little bit disturbing to me. You made a point saying that the rabbi is a pipe between God and us. And that's not Jewish. That's anti-Jewish, actually, the way I learned Judaism. Because in Judaism, we have a direct highway to God. You know, we can pray ourselves, we don't have to go to synagogue.
Everyone here are misnagdim. I'm looking for someone who is Hasidic.
So
someone.
From.
Anyone that is Hasidic, come from a Hasidic family. That
I'll give you the address.
Yeah. You're right. Some oppose it. Some oppose this. Some say, but some oppose, just like you said, some oppose the concept of a tzaddik, of a rabbi. Some say it's not a thing that is...
But I thought that was the difference between Judaism and Christianity.
No, it's different than a priest. It's a different than a priest. It's not a priest. They don't believe he's God. They believe he is in a higher spiritual hierarchy, and he is able to lift you and help you to connect by yourself to God. You don't connect... He's not the target. Kadosh Baruch Hu is the target. He's just a tool to help you connect you to God. He's not the target.
I find it disturbing.
No problem.
Think about it.
Sorry, Terry.
It's somebody who knows more than you.
It's somebody who knows more than you, experienced more than you.
That's a
right?
Is this a difference? right? Than having a teacher, right. Yes. And having somebody who is a pipe, who connects with God.